You're listening to The Sound Atlas by Russell Brooks.
So anyway, when I first started my first band in 1913, I played tambourine. I sang in the background. It was a choir.
You sang in the background?
I sang in the background. I was part of a background choir, banging on the tambourine a little bit.
I am sitting here with none other than Michael Farmer. Hello, sir.
Hi, Russell. I like that very official. I'm sitting here with...
I am sitting here with a guy named Michael.
Yes, you are.
Yep. Welp.
You're very fortunate.
I feel fortunate.
You're talking to a scene legend.
I know.
Unless... I did a lot of stuff that some people remember.
There's at least... A handful.
A handful of people remember the awesome things that I remember doing.
Well, when's the first time you remember being alive? A.K.A. where were you born?
Hammond, Indiana.
Hammond, Indiana. Where the heck fire is that?
That is northeastern tip of Indiana, close to Gary, right by the Illinois border.
Okay.
That's where Chicagoans go to get their guns and cigarettes and fireworks.
Okay.
They go across the border because everybody goes, what about Chicago when they talk about gun control? Like how gun control doesn't work? That's because people go to Indiana where gun laws are a lot less stiff than they are in Illinois.
A lot laxer there, yeah.
They go to Gary and Hammond and
okay.
They go get the stuff that they need to go commit the crimes that they're going to commit in Chicago.
How long were you in gun-ridden Indiana?
I lived there from 78. I was born in March 26, 1978. I lived there until I was on and off between there and Kentucky until 1984. That was when I think second grade, and I finally moved down to Kentucky, finally, and then just permanently moved here.
Stayed in Kentucky.
Yeah, because between birth and like the age of 5 or 6, I was kind of being whisked back and forth.
What's the first song you remember hearing?
The first song I remember hearing, you know what? Probably "Call Me" by Blondie. Or "Another Brick in the Wall" by Pink Floyd.
Who would have been playing these songs? Were you just on the radio, home, or
it would have been on the radio?
And when did you decide you wanted to get into music?
Oh, it was long after that. Years after that, actually. I was watching MTV, and I was watching a Bon Jovi video.
Mm-hmm. What Bon Jovi song?
"You Give Love a Bad Name." I just thought that was so cool.
Yeah.
I loved it. Actually, no, it wasn't just that. It was "Living on a Prayer," the video for "Living on a Prayer," where John Bon Jovi is on the wire and he's flying all over the... He's on stage, but he's flying through the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, wow, he's flying. I want to fly like that. I want to be a rock star who flies.
Yeah.
And neither of those things has happened, but, you know...
Still a spark.
You know, it was a dream. It was a dream. I've given up on flying and being a rock star. I've been on a plane, though, so there's that.
It's close.
Close enough.
So where did you go from there? Is anybody in your family musical at all, as far as singing or playing?
No, none of them. Not at all. They, you know, as far as I know, I don't think any of them have any involvement in music other than liking it.
What was the music you would have been exposed to at home?
Well, my grandfather used to, he would take me to bluegrass concerts in Rosine, which is not that far from where I lived, because we lived in Ohio County, and Rosine is the birthplace of
Bill Monroe.
Bill Monroe.
Jerusalem Ridge, everybody.
That's right. And he, and we actually saw Bill Monroe perform in Rosine, and we went other times that he wasn't there.
Right.
And I think some of that kind of got in my head, but I wasn't as into it as I was into, like, you know, we're halfway there. Ah! If Bill Monroe had been on a high wire flying through the crowd, right, I would have been all about it.
You need a little more theater in your music.
I need a little more theatrical explosions and,
yeah,
you know, I needed some, you know.
So did you sing at all when you were a kid?
No, not unless we were, not unless I was in, you know, singing with church, you know.
Right, so you sang in church and stuff like that growing up?
Just singing, well, singing the songs, you know.
Yeah, just singing hymns.
Hymns and stuff.
So what do you do after you see the video for Living on a Prayer? What's the first time you sing, I guess the saying is, contemporary music in front of people?
I still haven't done that.
You know what I mean.
Oh, I know. Okay, yeah. singing, I never, well, I wanted to be in a band. When I was in high school, I was like, I want to be in a band. And I didn't know how to make music, but I wanted to do it. And in high school is when I really wanted to, and I couldn't get anybody. I couldn't get a band together. So it was after high school. It was like I was maybe 19 years old. So that was the first time I ever played a show. I still didn't have a band. Okay. It was just me with a little keyboard,
mm-hmm,
and I was using the presets, like the preset rhythms.
Music and everything?
I was, yes. The preset beats, the little, here's the mambo beat, here's the rock beat,
right,
here's the 50s rock beat, here's the country beat. I'm going to use these and I'm going to make songs out of them. I'm going to make songs using them. And that was the thing I had to call. I didn't want to be Mike Farmer. So I gave myself a nickname and I called myself Mr. Neutron.
Right.
And that was the first thing I ever did. And that was, I was 19 years old.
Okay.
And
where did Mr. Neutron play?
Played in Owensboro, Kentucky at the Owensboro Sports Center. Okay. First show I ever did was a benefit for a street relief charity.
Okay.
And like homeless charity. And it was us and about me and me. I was told I had to have a band. It had to be somebody else in the band. It couldn't just be me on stage by myself with the keyboard. So I had a friend, my friend Chad. I put him. I lent him my bass guitar. I didn't even plug it in. I said, "Go ahead. You're gonna stand there and just pretend to play bass."
Right.
I guess that technically that was two of us. All right, that's two of us. We're a band.
That's the qualifications.
Yeah, that's it. And every now and then I'd have him play the slide whistle or something, and I'd be doing the rest on the keyboards and singing. So, and that was Mr. Neutron. I was Mr. Neutron, and he was Flopsy.
Flopsy?
Yeah. Chad was Flopsy.
So Mr. Neutron, is this all original stuff? Are you doing covers as well?
No, it was all original. Well, no, it wasn't all original. It was one cover.
Okay.
Was Alanis Morissette's Head Over Feet, mm-hmm, with using the disco beat on the preset on the keyboard. Right. It's a little dinky Yamaha.
Yeah.
And that was probably the best song
that you had.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember the first song that you wrote?
Well, I was always writing lyrics well before that, like all through high school. And I wrote like notebooks full of lyrics, but none of them turned into songs. But when I started doing this, I call the Mr. Neutron project.
Sure.
When I started doing Mr. Neutron, now I have to. And I was like, I have to write songs.
Right.
And I can't remember. There were just a couple of them right off the top of my head. One of them was like a mantra. I didn't even bother. It wasn't actually a song. It was just a mantra where I just held keys down and went, go to sleep, go to sleep, go to sleep, you're getting sleepy, go to sleep.
That was the whole song?
That was just me for like 2 or 3 minutes. It was just me, like a drone, me holding keys down, telling people to go to sleep.
Uh-huh.
And then there was another one I do remember called Country Life, which was a song about rednecks. I'm out like, this is country life. Get drunk and beat my wife. Mm-hmm. Listen here, mister. I'm going to do it with my sister. There you go. That was the chorus to. That was another. That, and there was the MF song, which was me taking the rap beat on the keyboard and literally just saying, instead of rapping, just saying motherfucker over and over and over again. And just, I didn't even bother trying to write anything. It was just like, motherfucker, 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 motherfucker.
What was the, that was Mr. Neutron Received.
I thought it went over real well.
So you're telling me in reality it was different or no?
I think that some people thought it was great.
Yeah.
Some people got a real kick out of it, and some people were like, this is awful. Mm-hmm. I'm sure some people hated it, and some people thought it was funny, and some people were like, whatever.
Well, I mean, I don't think you'd argue the fact, at least the earlier stuff, it obviously has humor built into it.
Oh, yeah.
And either you get it or you don't, right? So. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I didn't have a band. I was just me right. with my keyboard.
Is that why you were a little heavier, obviously, than your later stuff on the humor side of stuff, because you're like, this is kind of absurd anyway to an extent, I'm going to have to, or is that just something you wanted to do?
Well, it's something I learned from being a kid in school. Make fun of yourself before other people do.
Before someone else does.
Because you make a joke or be a joke, and I've taken that a little too far, but musically, I was like, if I can make the joke, if I can make myself the joke musically, then I can control it a uh-huh. lot better than I can if everybody else is making fun of me. Because I've had a harder time, you know, trying to be a, not, it's not that it's harder to be serious, but it's harder to go to people and approach them like serious, like I'm just like, here's the, now, I used to be really funny and now here I am, I'm gonna play you serious things. Now here's things that are more serious. What I'm giving them and what they expect from me.
Two different things.
Are two different things. And I'm just trying to satisfy myself.
Right.
Because that's all I can do.
Right. So after the, let's go back. So after Mr. Neutron, what do you do?
Mr. Neutron lasted a long time.
How long?
It lasted from 97. The hardcore period was from 1997 to 2001. That's when I finally, 2001 is when I moved to Los Angeles. I graduated college, graduated WKU.
And you moved to Los Angeles?
Moved to LA because I had a friend who moved out there a year before I did. And he said, you got to come out here, man. Mm-hmm. You got to come out here. So I kept playing. I kept doing Mr. Neutron stuff all throughout that time. Mm-hmm. I went out there and I think I played two or three shows as Mr. Neutron. And then I lived there from 2001 to 2003. I came back. I played a few more shows as Mr. Neutron. But then that was pretty much it. I've done.
Yeah.
So after that, I went to LA, and that's when Kentucky Prophet, well, that's when the Kentucky Prophet thing began. That became like, instead of me making fun of rap, I was still being funny, but I was actually rapping.
Right. So would the first Kentucky Prophet shows or songs, would you have been in LA at the time?
Oh, yeah. I would have been in LA.
You playing out as Kentucky Prophet in Los Angeles? Or?
Well, I only got to do a couple of shows. It was harder to get gigs in LA.
Okay.
Because just the whole situation out there is the music business is, especially the whole business out there is very strange and complicated. I don't understand it. I didn't understand it then. I'd probably understand it even less now. But I only got to play live out a few times. And the first songs I wrote were I had a couple of friends who were producers. We lived in the same apartment building.
Okay.
And they lived in upstate New York. And of course I got to know them a little bit, and we just kind of hit it off, and they gave me Kentucky Prophet. And it stuck. I was like, all right, I'm Kentucky Prophet. The best nicknames are the ones other people give you.
Right.
I gave myself Mr. Neutron. But...
yeah.
And I thought, well, you know, there's some really cool songs there. One was Holland, which was a song about, they had a really cool beat, and I was singing about living in a country house in Holland.
Mm-hmm.
In my little country house in Holland, we can watch the birdies fly away. In my little country house in Holland, we will soon seize the day. Now put a hip hop beat underneath that.
Right.
That makes no sense, but it makes it clicks, sense to me.
Yeah.
And I loved it. And the guys are like, well, we can't do it. Well, I guess that works, you know.
Yeah.
So that was one of the, I think that was either the first or second song we did together.
So you're in L.A. and you're...
making songs about birds. And
making songs about Holland.
And Holland.
What are you... I mean, when? What makes you come back to Kentucky?
I wanted to get the hell out of L.A.
Okay.
I hated it. I was having a hard time there. I was having a hard time. Couldn't find work. I couldn't keep a job, really. That's the main problem. I couldn't keep a job. And I wanted to come home. I got my tax returns, and I decided to take that money and pay some bills, buy a plane ticket, and come home.
Right.
So I came home summer 2003. And that's when I still kept doing Kentucky Prophet stuff, because I had songs. At that point, I was like, I'm doing a little bit of Mr. Neutron, a little bit of Kentucky Prophet, but then after a little while, I started to just ease into full-time doing Kentucky Prophet songs, and then I still kept collaborating with those two guys from New York, Ian and Colin, who they were just two good friends of mine, and well, we were good friends for a while, and I've kind of fallen out of touch with them. Sort of the thing about musicians, you sort of... You're tight for a while, then you're not so tight. It's not that you're like, it's not that you hate each other. You just
life
takes you
other
directions. You know, we did an EP and a full length together,
and they were called...
well, the EP was called Brain Rap, and the LP was called... the full length was called Beyond the Fringe, and. Beyond the Fringe has me on the cover, just with my arms on my hips, going big smiley face.
You see, I think that's actually the... to interject myself a little bit into it, I think that's the first time that I was aware of you. Mm-hmm. Is it My Life's Not Glamorous?
Yeah, it's a Wonderful Life.
It's that song. Yeah, that's the first time that... I mean, I didn't know you, but mm-hmm. that's the first time someone showed me something of yours.
Okay, that was the first time I'd ever had a music video made.
Now that was that shot in Ohio County?
Yes, I was.
Okay.
Most of it. Some of it was shot in Owensboro, because that day...
like the bar scenes or whatever?
Yeah, the club scene was shot in Owensboro.
Okay.
Because that day I had a show in Owensboro. It was at some pizza place they had punk shows at.
Right.
And the guy who shot the video, Drew Cook, he came down and we shot... all that video was at my house...
okay.
My grandfather is in the video, and my late grandfather, rest in peace. And then we went to the venue, and then we went there, and then we shot the last bit of it, and it was out of control, because a bunch of crazy kids there, and one of them comes on stage and tries to like... he's dry humping my leg, and mm-hmm. another one licks my chest, licks my sweaty... these are boys too.
Sure.
It's like not quite 18-year-old boys, who just... these are... I think we documented crime, like a sort of
to an extent,
kind of a fell... I think it happened to... it happened to me, though. I didn't perpetrate it.
What do you do after Kentucky Prophet? Even though you kind of, I think, still do it sometimes, hit or miss, right? But
yeah, I come home. This is after about a year after I came home, I got involved with this ragtag group of kids that would dog my existence for the next decade plus. I got involved with these guys. That one of them I kind of knew, and the others I didn't. A band that we eventually named Technology Versus Horse. And that band formed in 2004. Rafe Helsley, who I knew a little bit. He'd come to one of the wildest Mr. Neutron shows that ever existed. The one in Henderson, Kentucky, a place I would never play again. Because I'll tell you that story another time.
Okay.
But I don't want to get sidetracked. He'd been at that show, and it was sort of a... I wanted hazard pay for that gig.
Right.
And Matt Bittner... who played the bass, and our original drummer was a guy named Jamie Pickerel, and he was in the band for about a year, and then Jamie went back to Louisville. He was going to school at WKU, and he quit, dropped out, went back to Louisville. We didn't have a drummer for a while, so we weren't active. We were active just long enough to play some shows and develop an album worth of material. Mm-hmm. So we had an album of songs we could record. We just didn't have a drummer. And Jamie did actually come back and record that album with us. But we, about 2005, I think that's when we got Josh Hines to join us. Josh joined us on drums. Drums was not his primary instrument. He was a guitarist and bass player. Mm-hmm. Drums was not even close to the thing. It was not even close. When we started the band, Matt could barely play the bass, but then he just started woodshedding.
Right.
And he got way better. The thing he would do every day, he'd come home for lunch from his classes, and he would woodshed on Heart of the Sunrise by Yes. Mm-hmm. That opening line. And I'd hear him do that, and I'd hear him fumble, and he'd mutter his obscenity, and he'd go at it again. And that's how he got his practice in, learning that. And then Rafe had been in a band before, but I don't really remember anything about it. And I had done all this other bizarre garbage that I enjoyed, and I didn't know if anybody else, I was sort of a novelty weirdo. So we kind of were just, I think we were all kind of made for one another. Right. And then there was the first album with Jamie on drums. Our second album was called Four Against the Minotaur. That had Josh. And then after that, that's when David Prater joined in. He became the synth player. I did a little bit of keyboards before that, but I wanted to focus on being a singer. David joined and that was the lineup to the end of the band. David on keyboards, me singing, Josh Hines drums, Matt Bittner bass, Rafe Helsley guitar. And we made four more albums together. And we stayed together. David joined in the end of 2007, and we broke up. We played our last show spring 2017, right. Which is a long time for a local band to be together.
It is, yeah.
Far too long. But in our defense, what else were we going to do?
Yeah. I mean, also, if you like doing something... As with everything else, you cut down on the frequency, especially when things are winding down. I myself have done this several times, and mm-hmm. I'm just hard-headed and won't stop. But you cut down on the frequency, so what if I only played twice this year? What if I only played three or four times? And then mm-hmm. it's almost an excuse as time goes on, and at least in my situation, people get older, and life basically takes precedence. So you have kids, you have responsibilities, and it's harder and harder to get together, blah, blah, blah. I still want to see my buddies, I still want to play. Oh, yeah. So it's hard to completely stop, but I admire you for doing so.
Well, that's the thing that happened with TVH. Even before David joined the band, but when David joined up to the point, maybe up to the last 3 years of the band, we were pretty well active group.
Yeah.
But then that last 3 years, we just sort of tapered off because It's just people were unavailable.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
Yeah.
So we played maybe, we played three or four shows this year. All right. And then this year we played two shows this year. All right. We're only going to play, well, then 2017 we played one show. That was the last show. And we struggled to play. We put out one album. We put out, in that last 3 years, we struggled to the finish line. And I'm proud of the fact that the last album we made was called Diminishing Returns. I just think that's like, we made six albums as a band and we're still a local group. So clearly we're putting more in than we're getting out. I just like the idea of that being the title. Somebody came up with that. It wasn't me. I love that title, though.
Who would you say is primarily, or was primarily, in charge of the sound of TVH?
I would say primarily it was Matt and Rafe.
Okay.
Were the two that really kind of shaped the whole thing. I think that Matt is sort of was sort of the engine of the band, because a lot of we all kind of looked to him. Rafe really, it's weird because Rafe sort of also was very much a leader, but he also kind of looked, he wanted to play off what Matt was doing.
Right.
But there's also times where I felt like we're all in key and we're all playing in time to Josh, but we're not together. There are times I'm like, oh wow, we're swinging. Woo, all right, we're hitting it. We're cooking with gas now. And then there are times I felt like, is this jazz? Mm-hmm. Are we just playing jazz now? Because, okay, he's playing that thing, he's playing that thing, and he's playing this other thing. They're kind of related.
Right.
What do I sing to?
So the majority of the music would... Did you just show up and they're like, you guys jammed and they basically made a song and then you just wrote lyrics over it? Or is there sometimes when you would come in, you would say, I have these chords, mm-hmm. and then they would build a song?
I'd say 95% of the time they would have a part and work on that, hammer it together until they kind of had ideas of like, okay, this is this part and that part, and then they would try to figure that out. And I would write lyrics to what they were coming up with.
Right.
And then the 5% would be me coming in with, I have these chords and these lyrics.
Yeah.
And this is, and there's a couple of songs like that on, like Micronesia on the first TVH album is one that I wrote, I brought in. Drunk on TV is on the last one is kind of an example like that. I came in with two verses and choruses, two verses and like the chords, and they kind of took it and they figured out the ending, because I didn't have the ending of the song.
Yeah.
They figured out where it was going to go from there. And
as my grandmother would say, a little birdie told me that you were on, quote, the television.
I was on the television.
Can I hear more about that?
Okay. Way back in the day.
And it was more than one TV, I should clarify that.
Oh, yes, I was on multiple televisions.
Yeah, it was just a broadcast, just to clarify.
Way back in the day, in the day before high definition.
SD, they call it.
In standard definition, back when the TVs were big and boxy and not flat, before plasma, there was a network called Comedy Central. And one of the shows that it aired was a show called Beat the Geeks. Now, it aired around the same time and era of shows like Chappelle's Show and Insomniac with Dave Attell and Tough Crowd with Colin Quinn and BattleBots. Mm-hmm. But it's nowhere near as fondly remembered as any of those other shows.
Sure.
Now, Beat the Geeks, for those of you who definitely don't know about it, and most of you don't, was a game show. It was a game show about pop culture. with three main categories: movies, TV, music. And then they'd have a fourth category, which would vary week to week. Sometimes they'd have a Simpsons geek. Sometimes they'd have a horror movie geek, a comic book geek, a nudity in films geek. That guy, the nudity in films geek, went on to become Mr. Skin. And that's not a joke. You know MrSkin.com?
No, I don't know MrSkin.com. Have you ever,
MrSkin.com is like the guy who does, he's like the encyclopedia for women who get naked in films. Like, if you want to find out what films an actress has been in naked,
yeah,
you can look it up on MrSkin.com. Mr. Skin is the guy who was the nudity and film geek on Beat the Geeks.
Okay.
And he can tell you, if you want to find out, for example, what movie Salma Hayek was naked in.
Or, oh, so that's his whole thing.
That's his whole deal. That's his life's work. It's not just telling you about the nudity, but the quality of it.
And he's showing you.
And he's showing you.
We pull it up and, you know, parental guidance suggested. But okay, so he's on there.
He's on there, yeah.
And how do you get involved in Beat the Geeks?
I got involved because I was going to audition as a contestant. Mm-hmm. And I auditioned as a contestant, and I went to the studio. And after the contestant audition, I said, I pulled one of the people aside, one of the aides aside. I said, look, I don't know if you're looking for a music geek, but if you are, I don't know if you're holding auditions, I'd like to try, you know?
Right.
And as it so happened, they were looking for another music geek. They had used two different music geeks their first season, and they were keeping one. They were letting go of the other one.
One guy didn't cut it.
One guy didn't cut it. And they were looking for another one. So I came in and auditioned to be the music geek, and then I went through another audition.
What's that audition like? Do they just literally ask you trivia?
Some of it.
Check your personality, more or less? Or?
A little bit of both, yeah. They wanted to get to know me and my personality, and they wanted to see how I would compose myself sort of in a kind of informal game simulation.
Yeah.
Like, instead, like, I wasn't on the set, but I would be standing there, you know, just sort of like, okay, I'm behind this podium in an office somewhere, pretending that I'm on the game, mm-hmm. you know, pretending that I'm the music geek now, and...
Yeah,
and just sort of, and I sort of threw a little hitch in my shoulders, like I was Elvis somehow, and I never did that on the show. I was just like, I was stiff as a board on the show, but in the office, I was like, yeah, I got you, you know, I am your music geek, whatever, you know. And
so yeah, you get on Beat the Geeks.
I got on Beat the Geeks after like three or four auditions. Like, they gave me the job, and I did it. I did like 3 or 4 days of taping with those guys. And it's weird because I did like 15 episodes, I think.
Right.
And it was awesome. I had a great, you know, it was a great experience. I got to meet the host of Beat the Geeks. No, but I did. I met Lloyd Kaufman, who's the Troma Films guy, mm-hmm. Toxic Avenger. That
Toxic
was cool.
Avenger and all that. Yeah.
So I got my own dressing shed.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get a room. I didn't get my dressing room. I got a shed I could sit in that had didn't have plumbing. No, it had a sink. It did have a sink.
Just no bathroom.
No toilet.
Yeah.
No shower. Yeah. But I could sit in the shed and watch TV and.
Until it was your turn to,
to
be beaten as a geek.
Yeah, that did happen. In the final round, they could pick the contestant who won, because it was one-on-one, and then the one who beat the other contestant could pick the geek of their choice.
Right.
And the first one, I was picked twice. First time I won. Second time I didn't win.
Is that why you lost the job at Beat the Geeks?
I think it is. Also, in the fact that I made fun of like the sponsor. Now that I think about it, years later, I think I made fun of one of the things I did is I made fun of the sponsor, because one of the grand prizes that you could win was passes to go see the Violent Femmes.
Uh-huh.
And I said, Violent Femmes are overrated. When I knew I was going to lose, I said, Violent Femmes are overrated after their first album anyway. which that's probably not something I should have said.
Sure.
You know, you can't make it in LA if you're gonna. You can't
cross the sponsor.
You can't cross the violent femmes and expect to eat in LA.
Sure.
Yeah, you shouldn't insult sponsors.
Let me ask you this. What is the best song you've ever written?
Best song I have ever written?
Yes, sir.
I won't say I haven't written it yet. That's not true. I have written it. But I hope I write one even better than that soon. But I'll tell you what, the best song I've ever written is the one I came up with while I was, the little jingle I came up with while I was pouring chocolate milk. You want it? Let me sing it for you.
Please.
Drinking chocolate milk, chucky yucky yucky, drinking chocolate milk, chucky yucky yucky, drinking chocolate milk, chucky. That's a little song I sing to myself when I'm pouring me a glass of chocolate milk.
For the uninformed, Mike Farmer is a nice guy. I can be a bit of a smart ass.
Yeah, just a bit. No.
The best song you've ever written that people have heard.
The best song I have ever written.
Outside of drinking chocolate milk.
That people have heard.
Yes, sir.
Is, okay.
In your opinion, of course.
One, it's, I really do like more than, I've got so many I really do like.
Do not say drinking chocolate milk.
I'm not going to say it. I'm not going to say the chocolate
yucky,
milk.
Yuck, it is catchy.
It's catchy as hell. I'd say probably either... Probably one of the ones we recorded, The Concept of You.
Okay.
That's a very good song. Or.
It's a very good song.
It is a very good song. Or Mountain Music.
Okay.
Which I didn't record with you. I recorded that one in a church in Greenville, Kentucky. I sat there at the church.
Mm-hmm.
And on the piano they had there, a nice grand piano, and use a little. I didn't even use. I think I just. It was a nice. It's me and the guy recording it. You know, me and Patson. Remember Patson?
I definitely do remember Patson. Yeah.
We're in there, and the church has a little two track recorder, and I just. I mean, it brings a tear to my eye. It really does, because it's a song about, what's a song about playing, like, you play songs that people, like, do you want to, the whole idea is to play pleasant music at somebody's funeral to send their spirit peacefully along to the other realm.
Right.
And mountain music, if you live in this part of the country, you play a little mountain music, a little bluegrass, a little Appalachian sounds to send them streaming along, you know? And that's the whole idea, is we will sing for you, mountain music. We will sing for you on your funeral day. We will sing for you, mountain music. We will sing for you. Send you on your way. That one means the most to me because of personal significance.
Right.
It's also a very good song, but I put that one, and the Concept of You is also a great song just because I think it's got a great groove and
sure.
You can get into that
more regard. Of a pop element.
It's a poppy, but it's also kind of got a great, it's also got a kind of 60s beat kind of boom, boom,
boom, boom. Who's the best singer of all time?
I want to say Freddie Mercury.
Okay.
But
you won't.
He's probably the greatest rock singer of all time.
Okay.
I can't say. I'd say another great singer is Harry Belafonte.
Okay.
Those are probably two of the best.
What's the best show you ever had? In any band or, you know, form of yourself as a musician, what's the best show you've ever played?
Probably Technology versus Horse playing. It was probably a Technology versus Horse show, and it was either Starry Night, which was a big show for us because the simple numbers of people
right. And
how many people were into us, and what we just, I felt like we were on fire that night. That or Technology versus Horse playing Mayhem, I think the year before that, the night of the Uncrustables. That was another night where I felt like we were just on top of the world.
Right.
Where you didn't know about the Uncrustables, do you?
I don't know.
Somebody brought, I think it was the WKU radio station put on the show. Right. Somebody brought a box of Uncrustables, a giant box. You know what Uncrustables are? They're mm-hmm. Smucker's yes. things. They're not great. But there's a big box of them. And I thought, wouldn't it be something to just throw those out into the crowd in the middle of a song? So I didn't take the whole box, but I took like armful of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I took them on stage with me, and in the middle of one of the songs, I just started
pitching
them out.
Yeah.
I forgot that they could also be thrown back at me. So they started getting thrown back at the band, but mostly me.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you're out front too, so.
Yeah, I'm the front. And then somebody got the great idea of going backstage, and they didn't have to sneak because all you had to do was walk back around the stage, take the box, and then just throw the box, just take them into the crowd and just distribute them. And now it's just a big Uncrustables fight in the middle of Circle Square Park or whatever it is.
Circus.
Or was that what it's called, the park over here?
Circus Square.
Circus Square Park.
Well, I think so. I'm not going to swear to that.
But that show, regardless of that, was also one of the shows where I felt like we couldn't do anything wrong.
Right.
Even if we screwed up, it was great. Like everything seemed to be just. I'm going to say this, and this is going to sound kind of corny, but there are moments where I felt like with TVH, I was in the best band in the world. I know that ain't true. I know we weren't the best band in the world. And I know there is no best band in the world, but I felt that for a moment. I felt that a couple of times in my life. And I hope that everybody who ever gets to be in a band has that feeling. If only one time they get that feeling of, this is the best feeling in the world. I'm in the best band. We are on fire. Nobody can touch us right now. That's the feeling that I want, and that's the feeling I hope everybody who ever gets to be in a band has.
The few people I've talked to thus far, I mean, and typically, you know, it would even come from the question, you know, why do you play music? And it comes down to that to an extent. And once you have it, part of it is, sure would like to feel that again.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I've heard it called a release. I've heard it called therapy. But it all comes down to that one moment when everything's going good for you on stage and you look out and everybody's staring at you and it's like, okay, this is it.
I'm feeling good just thinking about it.
That's the validation, if you will, in my opinion, yeah, of us as musicians, mm-hmm. you know? Because we can't give it to ourselves. No. There has to be an audience, so.
No. And that's, yeah, that is, it's a beautiful experience. It's hard. It doesn't just come by all the time. Sometimes you play a lot of shows and you don't feel, you just want to get through it. And, and the audience is probably having more fun than you are.
Right.
But you try, you know. But
if you go back and tell little Mike, mm-hmm. little Mike Farmer, any advice for you starting out, what would you say to yourself? Don't do this, or do this more, or don't worry about this, or
I don't know where to start. There'd be so many things I want to tell him. I probably want to strangle him and be like, you little shit, you have no idea. You arrogant little bastard. You think you're going to set the world on fire, don't you?
How dare you badmouth the Violent Femmes?
You really think the Violent Femmes are... You know what? You have not accomplished one-tenth of what the Violent Femmes have done.
Do you know they wrote Blister in the Sun?
Yeah, they've done... Listen, their one album is way better than your entire career, big boy.
My friend, they are waiting on a bus and you don't even know.
Yeah, they could kneecap you next time they see you. Gordon Gano is pissed. No, I would... If I could tell my little Mike anything, I'd be like, you ain't gonna make it. Just have fun.
Right.
Try to have fun. Okay. These things will take care of themselves. Get more exercise.
What's the worst show you ever played or the worst trip?
Well, there's been so many bad shows, I don't want to distinguish between them. But I can tell you for sure what the worst trip was. And this is when I did the tour. I opened up for Frank Black. And I did this was 2006, Kentucky Prophet Tour. We were in Canada. I went in with him from the United States. I went in with him and his group together, and we left Canada together. We did all from Winnipeg to Vancouver, basically central to western Canada. And there's about five or six shows there. And I took all basically in between there, entering and leaving the country, I traveled by myself and I took Greyhound. A lot of the shows I did on that tour, I got from place to place taking Greyhound. And I took Greyhound from Edmonton to Calgary. That's a pretty long trip. But it was made even longer. This trip was even longer because we're going through the mountains and we had to stop. We had to stop because we were in the mountains and a semi flipped over on its side and blocked all lanes of traffic. Mm-hmm. And that added, first of all, they had to get the thing up and move it to, they had to do something to get up where it moves, to get the traffic going. And by the time they got that cleared up, the bus died. there was no more power, the battery died on it. Mm-hmm. So that was another issue. So they had to bring another bus from Calgary. This turn, it was going to be a 10-hour trip, I think. It ended up being 20 hours or something like that.
Why weren't you with, if you were on, because I don't know, if you were on tour with Frank, why weren't you allowed to, I guess, ride his bus? It's not like you had a ton of equipment.
He just suggested I take, when I was doing the thing, I was on the, first thing I did was, first of all, most of the dates we were going on were going to be pretty easy to travel with by bus anyway. And the thing is, that's, when you're on a tour bus like that, that's where the band lives. They got sleeping cars and everything. And they didn't have, they had enough for the band. They didn't have one for me.
Right.
So I could have stayed. I mean, yeah, the option would have been for me to, I could have sat on the bus. I could have been on the bus, but I would have been sitting in the lobby. I wouldn't have had anywhere to lay down.
Right.
So I could have ridden on the bus, but I wouldn't have had anywhere to. It wouldn't have been great.
You wouldn't have had your own space.
I wouldn't have had my own space.
How do you get hooked up with Frank Black as far as playing music with him on that tour?
This is another guy I met in L.A. I met him, long story. I met him at a comedy club, and I eventually started working for him for a little while, basically over summer, and about a couple of years later, I sent him the first Kentucky Prophet EP. Mm-hmm. And he'd loved it. He flipped over it. And then an opportunity came up to do some shows opening up for him because the guy who normally opened up for him couldn't make about half of the tour dates. Because Frank was doing a big nationwide tour. He was touring for he was doing a greatest hits album and doing a nationwide tour for it. And the guy he normally got to do it could only do Eastern Seaboard and the Midwest. Couldn't do the South, couldn't do the West Coast, couldn't do most of Canada. So there were about 18 shows that he said, "Yeah, you can do this if you want."
Yeah.
And I said, "I don't know if I can do it." And that's when he put the idea, I don't know, how am I going to get there? And then he gave me the idea of going Greyhound, taking Greyhound to these shows. because he's like, Jonathan Richman does it. Jonathan Richman does it all the time. Mm-hmm. And he used to take Greyhound all the time. Just not to shows, but he used to do it just traveling. It probably was a little bit nicer when he did it as a, you know, as a youngster, because it's kind of a soul crushing experience. I gotta tell you, and it can be really. One time I was on Greyhound going from Memphis to Dallas, and I was sitting next to a guy, little old guy. He was going to Reno from Memphis, which on a bus takes like over a day. If he'd been on a plane, he'd been there like in like 6 or 7 hours. But he was talking to me about all the bad bets he'd made. Like he was like, he'd lost $3,000 on a NFL playoff game. I'm like, no wonder you're taking the bus.
Right.
And it's just one of those things when you're riding the bus and you hear a baby crying, you hear a mother trying to comfort the baby, and you're not even mad at the baby, you just kind of envy him. Like, I wish I could cry. I don't have the capacity to cry anymore. I just don't even feel emotion anymore. I just envy the child because I don't even want to shut the baby up. I just want to know how. Right. How do you channel that? How do you get that? I want to cry too. I just can't. I envy the baby.
What was the reception like for Kentucky Prophet when you were doing those shows?
Just some confusion.
Yeah.
Some good review. You know what? I don't think I got a good review on that tour. I went back at the end of the tour, I went and looked online and did some vanity searching for looking to see if there were any tour reviews. And I don't think I got a positive review, but I don't think I got a single one. I think it was kind of like that very first Mr. Neutron show. Some people thought it was funny. Some people thought it was stupid. And some people didn't care.
Right.
And the ones who thought it was stupid were probably the ones who wrote the review.
They're typically the loudest as well.
Yeah, the ones who thought it was funny, you know. Hey, look, I went I took a bunch of CDs to sell, sold them out.
There you go.
So there you go. Somebody must have liked it. You know, and I charge inflated Canadian rates for those, you know.
Right.
So, yeah, I played the Fillmore. I played the Fillmore in San Francisco.
Right.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, I also played Four Houses of Blues. That's, you know, that's fine. But I played the Fillmore.
Yeah.
You know.
So if nothing else, you got that out of the deal.
I did that. Me, the Dead, Janis Joplin, my Kentucky Prophet. You know,
it's above the door right when you go in.
Yeah.
Kentucky Prophet. Janis Joplin.
Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Jefferson Airplane.
It says, it's actually word for word.
Word for word, yeah.
Because who cares, really?
You
got the major three.
Yeah, I mean, really, what did they do? White Rabbit? Come on.
And with that, ladies and gentlemen, the one, the only, the meanest man in local music.
I am.
Michael Farmer. He's a sweetheart.
Oh,
thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Russell.